is Maria. I work with Dr. Sharifuddin, SRPI, Judith, who is our primary study coordinator, and also I would like to acknowledge the presence of Dr. Stephen Lentz, who is our representative today. He is our medical therapy co-investigator, and we are really very fortunate that we have a co-investigator that's dedicated to enroll patients who have problems with this condition, like venous PDS. So I guess the number one thing, or it would be a very dedicated co-investigator who will be seeing patients with this kind of condition. Because every vascular surgeon had their own kind of specialty. Like they enroll different kind of patients, but in our team, aside from the very dedicated, there will be an active co-investigator who is actively enrolling patients.
How do you, as a study team and as a coordinator, how do you encourage that to occur? I mean, in other words, I think that certainly we all have partners and we all have colleagues in our practices, but somehow keeping them looped into the study and all that, are there things that you do in particular to try and, how do you foster that communication and that sense of being part of it?
For our investigator, she is a Dr. Weger. She just joined our team about two years ago, and the way she let us know that these patients are, you know, potential or eligible patients to enroll is through Epic. So most of us are using this medical record system, and she will email us, and ahead of time she already had the idea or the inclusion exclusion criteria in mind, and she will let us know that these patients are potential patients to enroll. So I guess active communication through different kinds of media and everything like that. So.
And how, in terms of engaging Dr. Lenz's team and kind of keeping that kind of connection, you know, I know that Dr. Lenz has had a long-standing commitment to this area in general, obviously, but having said that, you know, how is it? Because, you know, every team, I would say, I think we all have hematology colleagues. The level of investment and engagement in our study team, though, varies a lot from site to site, you know? It takes some active work to build that, you know? And is there anything in particular that you do, I guess, to help that? So.
Together, fortunately, we're very fortunate that our investigators are on hand with this, hands-on with this study. So what we do is, most of the time, the patient comes in baseline assessment. We send emails to Dr. Lenz, the nurse that works with her. And also that part, even though she's not part of the study, we try to communicate with her ahead of time. So they will know that this patient is coming along, or we schedule it ahead of time. So, active communication.
Yeah, that's great, yeah. Any additional thoughts there, Christy? Or other things that you do at your site to kind of maintain buy-in and get the word out?
Excuse me. I was just talking a little bit about our recruitment efforts. I work with Dr. Desai, who's the PI, and it's basically the two of us who are, we have other sub-investigators, but we're really committed and work well together, and he's very reliable and approachable. And last year we did a lot on the internal awareness of the study within Northwestern, and we're still doing some of that, and mainly Dr. Desai started a lunch and learn where he's getting on the schedule of various departments, and he's done three of those with internal medicine and ED and fellows, and we got a couple potential subjects out of that. And we're still doing the check-in and getting on the schedule for vascular surgery. But what we're gonna focus on now is the access to external patients. And that's, first of all, involved Dr. Desai going to a lot of conferences and speaking, and he always talks about the study during those times. And then we have some new avenues that we're excited about. For our site, we finally got access to the electronic records to go through for recruitment. So that's a good thing. And our radiology department started a newsletter and Facebook, and they're gonna let us put a blurb about the study in that. And Northwestern, they're starting the Chicagoland recruitment portal. And what that is it's a digital matchmaking portal where patients can sign up with the areas that they're interested in, and then they're gonna be notified of potential studies that they might be interested in. And there's no cost, it's NIH funded, and there's a lot of different, the major hospitals and universities are participating in this. So we have some things we're looking forward to getting involved in.
How did you find out about the portal?
I've been in touch with our different recruitment departments at Northwestern, and it's just something that along the lines that I found out about, and it's gonna launch this spring.
Sure, I mean, resource awareness is always a tough thing, whether you're busy in your own little siloed part of whatever institution you're in, but you seem to have reached outside that, which I think is a terrific. And in the Lunch and Learns, have you only dredged up study patients or patients that you're managing in your practice now?
Well, there were two potential ones.
Okay, that's what I'm asking is that, I mean, there's a potential there to grow your practice as well, a little bit, right?
Yeah, the Lunch and Learns, I think the problem is that with venous disease, that even in big places, people don't really know that these patients have an MD, right? So the common theme we hear is like, well, he's been like this, or she's been like this for 30 years. And then you show, like, well, there are not only possibly therapeutic options and targets that we can address, but there's actually a federally funded trial. And so when I was thinking about where to go with the Lunch and Learns, we already have buy-in from the specialty community. We don't have buy-in from the owners of the patients, right? And so that's where we decided to focus our efforts. That's where surgeons and our institution, they agree with it, that they're gonna send their patients. That's not where we're getting the patients. We're getting them from the GIM docs, the general medical medicine docs that say, well, geez, I can look back and I got a patient that had to be back from the subject. Really is about leaving them still unsure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Riaz at Temple, you've been using some interesting sources of referral. Do you want to talk? Can you mention talk about that a little bit?
Sure. True story. Sure. You know, we participated in a tract, so we had a base to do this kind of trial. I think the interesting thing that Temple has a very large chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension program. And we get a lot of referrals for CTEPH. And one of the interesting things is we started looking at their legs and found that a lot of them had post-thrombotic syndrome. And so we would, usually they would be referred for surgical thromboendarterectomy, and we would do a pulmonary angiogram on them. Now, if these patients came to the cath lab, and when we looked at their leg, if they had significant post-thrombotic syndrome, we would also do a venogram at that time. And what we found was interesting, that 26% of these patients had some form of iliac obstruction. And patients were really gratified to know that there was a cause for their PE and the chronic CTEPH. because a lot of these patients never heard of this problem. So that builds a relationship, and I think pulmonary hypertension docs, particularly CTEF experts, are a very good source of these post-thrombotic syndrome patients. And because I work in the cath lab, so I do venograms on them, and that gives me the first stage. And the second thing, I think, from a patient's point of view, is patient is suffering, and I just focus on trying to tell him, what can we do to help you? And then, as Patty just showed, and then just tell him that, you know, there is this study we are doing, and I wanted to emphasize that for all the referral sources, is whenever I talk to primary care physicians, or I talk to hematologists, or my CTEF colleagues, I sell them the trial, not the stent, because those are the patients I actually had to stent if the physician told them that stenting is going to help you. These patients are suffering, just like Ron just showed us, and they're not going to agree usually to randomizing. So I basically tell my CTEF partners, you know, this is a very good opportunity for our patients to participate in the study, and not, please don't talk to them anything about stent. And usually our partners are very good, and they understand it. I think the other thing at Temple that has been incredibly helpful is our personal relationship with other specialties like vascular surgery. You know, I'm a cardiologist, and vascular surgeons have been very good in helping with the recruitment, with the wound care, with the you know, the medical therapy of the post-thrombotic syndrome. So I think collaborating with other specialties, and including hematology, has been really, really helpful in recruiting these patients and actually randomizing them.
Thanks. I'm interested in the kind of in the site network, I guess, or in the best. How many of you feel that, you know, for every patient that gets referred to your practice, there's got to be 10 other patients with PTS or moderate or severe PTS that are in your institution? And I'm curious, what we found in our site is that there is two or three benign hematologists that see a large number of these patients, you know? And for the first year in the study, even us actually, because things have kind of changed in our hematology division, we really didn't have a line necessarily into those specific people. Once we got those specific people involved, all of a sudden we're getting lots of referrals there, and they're kind of higher quality referrals because, you know, the challenge is that when you get referrals from another endovascular physician, they've already kind of been, or even when you could send a patient, they've already kind of been primed towards the idea that they're going to get some intervention. And but getting them from hematology is beautiful, really, because they tend to get a more balanced explanation of what it is that we're doing, you know, as long as that person is kind of on board, right? But I'm curious, within the site network, how many of you really feel like I have identified, you know, the two or three medical physicians in my institution that probably see the most of these patients? How many of you feel that you really identified that? Okay. A few of you, yeah, a few of you. But maybe I'm going to guess probably not the majority, and we certainly wouldn't have counted ourselves in that either probably about a year ago. But I think that as a to-do item, I think it would be very important to really say, okay, within a month from now, we should all know who are those people in our institutions, right? And have we really met with them and talked to them about the study, you know? Because they're, and these are people that likely will be committed to this area, and you know, they see these patients as well. They probably don't pay as much attention on average to the leg symptom side of the equation, but nevertheless, I think that they do see the patients, and the ones that have moderate or severe disease, they probably have noticed they're not doing so well either and would be willing to help, you know. Especially in the context of an NIH study. If they were gonna, they may not be referring people to stent for stenting generally, but for an NIH randomized trial, they might be much more open to it, you know. We certainly found that with, you know, I think our volumes for DVT license were highest during the ATTRACT trial than they had ever been before, and certainly not after, you know. So, yeah.
You know, another interesting source of these patients is, you know, we started a BERT program 3 years ago at Temple. And every time a pulmonary embolism patient gets, there are a lot of specialists on the call. And a lot of those patients have both thrombotic syndrome or have acute DVT. And those are kind of patients that would keep an eye on and watch out for them. So that's another source of these post-traumatic syndrome patients.
Yeah, it's interesting because nowadays the way that the hype is moved, a lot of the engagement of endovascular type physicians in the care of VTE patients comes around PE nowadays. You know, a little more than maybe before, right? Relative to DVT, right? That's shifted a bit, and so it may be that there could be some. Obviously, the PE patients immediately have other concerns, but nevertheless, overall, in the long run, it could be another way to identify patients. And plus, in a context of a multidisciplinary approach, which is kind of related, I guess. You know.
So I just want to add on that I think that it is incredibly difficult to find a pure benign hematologist. A big institution like yours has three. We have two. One kind of does myelodysplastic syndrome. The other two are pure benign hematologists. And so if you can find those folks, I mean, you already see that their clinic schedules booked out like months. And I have to make a personal call to them to squeeze somebody. And they accommodate it. But they have such a crushing load of patients that there's going to be tons of PTS patients there, right? And then they're happy that they're involved in this and they have an interest in PTS. All the weaknesses of that, along with other disorders, of course. But if you can go back to your home institutions and find the practitioner, and maybe some smaller institutions may not have a pure benign hematologist, but if you can find a person that's seeing a ton of VTE follow-up, that's, I think, an untapped resource.
And I would ask them also, who are their two or three colleagues in that local area, you know, who also might see, because they'll know who the other hematologists are in town that see lots of benign hematology. And remember, a physician, a provider-to-provider contact is not an IRB-regulated activity per se, right? If you try and approach a participant in another institution, that absolutely you can't do without IRB approval in that institution and everything else, right? But provider-to-provider communication is absolutely appropriate. And so, you know, reaching out to those kinds of folks as well to see if they're open to referring people for this purpose can also be helpful. But I think the first priority is in your institution. Yeah.
So I may be the only benign hematologist here, I'm not sure. But I'm from the University of Iowa, I work with Maria. So I agree with everything you're saying. We have a lot of patients in the benign hematology clinics. I have two colleagues, and the three of us see all these patients. The communication with the team is really important. So I want to be able, if I raise the possibility with the patient that I may want to refer them to the subject, I need to be able to communicate with the team and get them in quickly. Because if they're on the fence about it, it takes them 3 months to get in to see an appointment, they're going to lose interest. And the same thing when there's a study patient that I'm asked to see, it really helps to have the emails, the cell phone numbers. And so if I refer a patient, I know they're going to be jumped on and get in quickly. That can be really helpful. Also, you know, I think our practice in the past in benign hematology was to think of intervention only in the most severe patients, you know, the ones that are really struggling, rather than the more moderate patients. So I think we need to raise our awareness that probably a significant number of patients that we see that may have moderate leg symptoms, you know, might benefit from or might be eligible, or might benefit from being in the trial. So I think there's an education process among hematologists to think about this more often.
I know. Thank you very much. That's really helpful. Deepa.
You know, to echo that comment, I mean, I have not enrolled anyone, you know, yet, but reaching out to the hematologists, you know, when I think there's a lot of education, you know, that needs to be done. My wife is hemoc, and she's also learned a lot about, you know, DBT friendly. And she said, you know, this is not taught to us in our training. I give the Penn Fellows a talk now every year on what we can do. And if it wasn't for that talk, they're not exposed, you know, to it at all. But, you know, as we try to get the benign hematologists, you know, on board, what was very interesting when I started kind of trying to build the practice, the biggest devil's advocate in the room was benign hematology, because obviously there's no data tracked and stuff wasn't out. And there was a hematologist who, at every grand rounds that I gave, was the devil's advocate in the room. And I was first year attending, and asked me the hardest questions. And I went home and I said, honey, that guy showed up again. And I don't know what to do. And she said, what does he look like? And I described it. And she said, that's Charles Abrams. And I was like, who's Charles Abrams? She said, he's the president of the American Society of Hematology. And I met with him, and I just said to him, I said, because obviously you have to be able to prove that you can do these cases too. I said, just send me one chronic patient. It was an IVC occlusion, and we did that. And now we've established a good relationship so that now when you have this trial on board, they can say, hey, look, we know what, you know, can be done, and I think this is a legitimate trial to undertake. So I think the education is very important.
Yeah,
cut it down.
So a couple along these lines, I think the thing that, and I always have to remind myself, is that if you go and you talk to somebody, you know, even my own partners, and then you talk to them like 6 weeks later, and they're like, oh yeah, what was that trial you're doing? And you gotta keep going back and reminding and re-reminding over and over, because you know, as you get your clinic, you got your 30, 40 patients to see, you're just running to get through, you might see a great patient. So try and have a way that you or your team can just constantly remind all the potential sources that it's going on. Be a nuisance.
Ron,
So one thing, I'll make two anecdotes. So benign hematologists, when I was at Cornell, we also had one to two benign hematologists that participated in this. And one of our most successful routes of getting patients at that institution was we created a thrombosis board. So many IRs have tumor boards, other types of boards. And so we created a monthly meeting where we got together as a multidisciplinary team, and everybody would bring patients to that meeting. And it created a real great throughput of patients. And a communication pathway to make sure patients got to us and that they didn't get lost in the general referral pool just through Epic or through whatever the EMR is. And then the other comment is benign hematology is great, but institutions are different. And so my current institution at Jefferson is much more vascular medicine heavy. And so the vascular medicine group also can act like a benign hematologist, and they're going to see a high volume of these patients as well. And they may be wound patients if they, you know, run a wound care center as part of that practice. Mm-hmm. And those wound patients are going to have a high percentage of venous disease as well.
So along those lines, one other thing that I think that has helped us is similar to the thrombosis board idea is that we have a multidisciplinary clock clinic. So two Fridays a month, the hematologist has a packed schedule. And we don't know anything about those patients. Some of the DBT follow-ups we do, but otherwise it's just referral to hematology. And myself and the PH pulmonologist are available. Not in the clinic physically, but we're available. And then she'll see somebody and she'll say, okay, this patient has leg symptoms. Can you come up and see him? And then run up and see him. And then we worked out building for visit and all that kind of stuff, but what that means is that that patient isn't seeing anywhere from one to three providers at the same time, and they love it, right? That's the pediatric model of multidisciplinary care. And I think it really works well here because then you capture the patient. They're not having to come back to the hospital. They know about what options are available to them. And it just streamlines the care pathway that much more.
And that's a really interesting idea. And obviously, a lot of us have busy procedural schedules like you do as well. But I think that idea that, well, maybe if you, in your interaction with a medical provider, say, well, look, if you see a patient, let me know. And if I can get up there, I will get up there, you know? That might be one route to take as well, you know, because if it can be done efficiently, then people are a lot more likely to have to go with it, right? Yeah. Susan, do you have any thoughts to add here?
Sites, do you have your study coordinators make themselves available to run up to a clinic? You know, if you're in the procedure suite and you're not available, as a hematologist, should I call your study coordinator to come see my patient in real time rather than refer them back to you for a separate visit?
Right, so I don't think Christy's come up to Cloud Clinic, but what we work out is she has a list of patients that she looks over basically the week before and kind of does a chart biopsy and says, okay, these two or three might need one of you guys, you know, CTEP patient, CTED patient, whatever, or this patient has PTS. They may need you. Here's roughly the time, and then we communicate back and forth and we make sure. So you can plan ahead for it. And then, of course, there have been times I'm scrubbed in and, you know, she'll say, well, how long is it going to be? And all but one time the patient has waited more.
Being proactive about, you know, there are different places in the system where patients like this might show up, and doing your best to try and be proactive about trying to figure out when. I think that's a great idea. And we talked a lot about using informatics tools for screening, but I guess the clinic schedules and things like that are maybe also higher yield options.
I just wanted to ask from everyone in the group. So we have a VA hospital nearby that doesn't. Is not going to be a site that would enroll. But if they refer patients to us, that gets complicated in terms of the medical follow-up because the VA system wants them, you know, they would send them for us to us for the endovascular portion. Has anyone encountered that where, you know, for specialty, recommend that?
Well, so I'll start. Someone get Mike to Angela to talk about some of the regulatory stuff. We have tried to work through this a couple times. I think that a lot of it just comes down to the planning. It is challenging to enroll VA patients in something like this, you know, just because of all the potential things that might need to get paid for, the potential visits that might need to happen, yeah. There's no question about that. And I think, San Francisco, right? We're looking at, there's a VA out there that we...
Right, yeah, Palo Alto, the VA, we were still trying to get through the regulatory. But I think you, Dr. Desai, actually have some overlap and have experienced this directly with a patient or two.
Yeah, we have our second syllabus in the patient.
And so how did you, in terms of like free follow-up visits and other care and compression and other things like that, how did you kind of...
So basically what we've worked out is, I know his primary provider, or I have her personal phone number, and for all of the prescriptions and all that kind of stuff, she does it under our guidance. And so when he comes, he's got a fee basis, which is like the non-VA referral setup to get his ultrasounds and all that kind of stuff done at the accredited site. But then my visit with him is not built, basically. I entered into the chart as a research, whatever, the other, and then I sent the copy, paste, and I email it to her, and so she knows what's going on. So that's our workaround.
So it can be done.
Yeah, we did it for our second summer.
Okay, so we can probably broaden the discussion to any barriers in enrollment overall. We're sort of already on that a bit, I think, but you know, I'd be interested to hear what questions people have, what thorny challenges they've had, I mean, or other issues with the study. And I think it's a good time to make sure that your any questions you have or concerns you have are addressed and answered, I guess. How many people are using, what modalities are people using to diagnose iliac vein obstruction? When we had our meeting last year, that was a substantial barrier to patient entry, was just the fact that getting the diagnosis made was challenging. We talked a little bit about using IVUS earlier, but I mean, are people more routinely using venogram and IVUS diagnostically, or are we still mostly relying on CT, and do we feel like we're still losing patients from just the inability to diagnose the problem?
Yes, sir.
you know, I'm just using mostly angiogenogram, and if a patient is totally occluded vein or critical stenosis, then I wouldn't do the IVUS at that time. And then I would do an IVUS in patients who have non-critical stenosis. I think I make the diagnosis before I talk to the patient about the study, so that when the patient sees me in the clinic, I can actually tell him that you do have a blockage, and what we don't know is whether the stent helps.
John?
Yeah, so the issue that I've had is to try and send them to a venogram first, or to do a venogram first, is then you're saying to a patient, well, I'm going to do a procedure and do a second procedure, and their feeling is if you're going to do the procedure, just decide to do it. So I've been sending the patients for CT, and the challenge with CT is it's very hard to get a good CT, and I agree with you, Suresh. When you ask for a CT venogram, invariably you get a CT angiogram, and because the timing is so difficult to get right, and then you're sort of in between, and you know, in those patients you sort of say, well, I'll just try and enroll them, because if it's close, you kind of make the judgment that it's probably needed. But yeah, CTs are terrible, and in our institution, MRs are completely useless. They don't time the MRs at all.
Sure, I'll say we actually got some guidance from Cush actually, you know, the CT scans we were doing, and that the routine protocol has been about a 3-minute delay. And with some information from Cush, we moved that up and developed an iliac vein protocol for CT and got it into the Epic system and everything, so it can be ordered, you know, for a 2-minute delay. Now, that helped the image quality a bit. However, I've got my patient last week, you know, had a reasonably well enhanced CT scan. But look, she had an iliofemoral DVT. She's been symptomatic since then. There was nothing down below, you know. I mean, I had a very high likelihood that this woman has a problem up there, you know. And the CT scan was read as negative, and it didn't look too bad. I put her on the table and did a diet. I talked to her and said, look, we can proceed with just trying to treat you based on what we have. But quite honestly, I think that it's pretty likely that you have an abnormality up there that we just haven't diagnosed. And she was okay with having a diagnostic a venogram with IVUS, and we did that, and indeed, she had about a 65% narrowing of her external iliac vein right near where the artery crosses there, you know, and then we're going to enroll her in the trial, you know. But in reference to what you said, John, I had the exact same reservation up front. We didn't approach that, but I think the one point that Aki Sista made at the last meeting was that if you're taking the posture of randomization in a study like, what you're saying is that if you have moderate or severe PTS and iliac vein obstruction, it's okay to treat you with or without stenting. And I do think that, just say we take someone in clinical practice who we're not gonna stent, okay? Knowing that someone has the iliac vein obstruction, I think is still helpful information, frankly, in explaining symptoms. When you think about ablating their saphenous vein, the way you talk to a patient in terms of expectations may be different, knowing what the lesion is versus not the lesion. Sometimes it might influence your choice if the patient's on the fence on how you compress them. There are different ways in which it can help the patient, you know. And I haven't, you know, so far, I'm not gonna say every patient would be open to that, but having said that, it's a very low risk thing to do, you know. I mean, really, we think about venography is invasive. Yeah, it's invasive, but remember, we're not dealing with C2 or C3 patients here. We're dealing with people with a very serious medical issue and an incompletely characterized understanding of what is causing it, right? So I think in this patient population, I'm comfortable with the idea of doing venogram and IVUS in these people for diagnostic purposes and then randomizing them afterwards. And remember, if they don't randomize to control and the study finishes and stenting works, I know they've got an abnormality, and I can send it then if I need to. You know?
Right. I like the idea of knowing before you even approach the study, is to say to the patient, you know, you have this lesion, you have this problem, I think you need to go and take a look and see if this is real, and then deal with it afterwards. The other thing is, if there's a protocol that you found that works, is it possible to forward it to us so we could sort of talk it over with our radiologists and see if they could improve the image quality that we're getting as of right now?
Sure. Yeah.
think I talked to Elizabeth.
Yeah.
That's probably too late at this point, and maybe too cumbersome, but the best CT images we get would be a direct injection from the lower extremity. Is that ever considered to be part of the...
You can do it that way, but it's almost the same thing as doing the beating ram, right? I guess if I was going to say, if I was going to stick the leg,
yeah,
why not do the IVUS?
Well, no, I mean, this is just, you're just sticking with a 20 gauge or 18 gauge in the foot, just like you're sticking the hand. It's no different than that. Hand versus foot has no difference. It's actually easier in these patients who are venous congested, and your time is a lot better. Images are significantly better than any CT product, because the, when you inject it from the arm and try to find that, you know, 3 minute, 1/20 second, whatever, it's a shot in the dark. It's like, you're lucky you'll get a good image, you're not lucky unless the text keeps scanning the patient over and over. You're gonna miss it on every other patient.
I think it's perfectly appropriate to do it. I mean, I don't see a problem with, I mean, like, for example, if you see the abnormality that way, I think it's perfectly usable, you know. It's just, you have to have the local set up to do that, right? And to get them to time it right and make sure it gets done, you know, properly and all that, you know.
What is the experience with MRA?
I found that MRI actually gives a pretty good image, and you can see exactly the delineation of the vein and the artery. You can see the difficulty is it's not center line, so if it's a little kind of bulging on the side, but typically if there's an area of narrowing, just in my limited experience, I found it to be pretty good.
I mean, we found that MR is pretty, and when we had Ablamar, you know, when we had the, you know, that was great, because, you know, that was a long-acting contrast agent, the timing issue was just gone, right? So then you would pretty much reliably get good images. I think now, you know, I don't find that it's that much better than the CT in our hands, but I'm, you know, that's here for others.
The problem with MR is that if you're recycling, is our research center and has very experienced people. Like, for example, we have dedicated cardiac vascular imagers that literally protocol every MR, and on the table they get a call and they're looking at it. So our MR quality is going to be good, but that's not something that I think is generalizable. The spatial resolution, you know, and if you're looking for other anatomic information, yeah, MR is not going to be the same as CT. The time, it's a significant amount of time. I agree with you, once Ablamar is gone, the multi-hands and all that other stuff is just not the same. I mean, Paramount's call might be okay, but the thing about CT, at least in our experience, is the contrast pulse is important, of course, but you can really get a good look at the morphology, assuming that it's the average sort of weight person. They're not retroperitoneally fat deficient, and they have a good amount of retroperitoneal fat. You really get a good look at the morphology of the vein, and if it's small and thin, and so that's been every patient that we've randomized, it's like you don't even need the contrast, frankly. It's tiny, it's post-traumatic. And you know that they had a DVT in that limb X number of years ago.
Thank you.
Yeah, the other thing I would say is that we have pretty long wait times for MRI at our institution relative to CT. I don't know about others, but that makes it also a very difficult thing to get done in a time, kind of a timely fashion. I want to ask how do you find that you're losing patients in terms of enrollment based on issues that relate to either transportation or the costs and convenience of just coming to of coming to see you? I know we've had some of those just kinds of different kinds of transport issues. I mean, we had one absolute saga in arranging transport, you know, and the patient said, oh, well, then magically got solved because she was going to buy a car, but then the car didn't work, and it was just, it was unbelievable, really, you know. But I'm curious, are sites having those kinds of issues with just patient transport and all that?
Suresh, I had a good example of a patient who came from Wisconsin for CTEP, and the C-Tract app helped me identify the C-Tract investigator in Wisconsin presenting on the enrollment. So, and I talked to the person, and it was very helpful.
Well, that's good to know, yeah. Has anyone succeeded in getting others to download the app on their phone? And I'm asking, I mean, obviously the people that already know how to refer to you, there's little additional value in giving them the app, obviously. They already know how to reach you, right? But in terms of other kinds of providers or colleagues in your local environment, you know, I think the app can be a very quick way to refer patients. You know, it's a very painless 10 seconds and, you know, way to do it. And so trying to get the app onto people's phones, like for example, you know, if I had a hematology colleague that was in town, but not in my own institution, the app is a way to not have to have the telephone number available or my email address available or the protocol in front of them, right? They can just go into their app and boom, the referral can happen, you know. I think that's where the advantage of that, you know, could be. But having said that, the challenge we've had is getting people to download it, you know. It's just, people just don't want to add another app, you know, and that in itself is a big barrier to use, even though it could be a very useful tool. Are people using it or sharing it with others? Not a whole lot at this point.
We always put it up if you don't know if people are downloading.
Right.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Angela, do you know how many, do you know?
I think it's been a little bit difficult. A little bit difficult for our vendor to track at this point, so we're waiting for the updated metrics.
I see. Yeah, excellent.
we've lost two patients to cost, based on pre-authorization deductibles.
Yeah, and the cost issue is a challenge. It's one that's not easy to overcome too easily. In terms of if, for example, insurance says we're not going to pay for the stents, the stenting and all that. I mean, the one thing I will say is that there are differences. Sometimes the issue is the procedure, and they wouldn't pay for it no matter what, even if the patient was off study. And sometimes the issue is that if the patient's on a study, they get flagged. And then they view it as, okay, patient's in research, I'm not going to pay for that. In that situation, sometimes you can appeal that and have discussions with them and explain that, look, this isn't just some new device or something like that. This is an NIH trial. We're doing a cost-effectiveness study. You're going to get that data. And in a track, that was actually effective. Now, the world has changed even for the worse in the U.S. since the track, even, right, in terms of the cost issues and all that, and insurance and all that. But if the issue is just that the patient's on a study, you may be able to try and get them to reverse that based on the fact that the kind of study it is, it's one that's going to actually help them cut costs, maybe, you know. But when it comes to if the issue is that they just won't pay for stenting, period, end, that is a difficult one, you know.
That's been high deductibles. That's just,
I see.
That's
right.
The nature of insurance.
Right. Yeah. But I think overall, in terms of a percentage of screens that have been excluded that way, it's still reasonably modest, given when you consider what the expenses are and all those kinds of things, right? So far, it's been reasonably modest, you know. So I don't think it's been as, it could be worse, I think. You know, it's not perfect, but it could be worse.
And I think we've told those patients that if there's a time that
there are people that may exclude up front, but then you can rescreen them later. There are people that, I mean, I think the vascular ultrasound labs, look, you know, a zillion ultrasounds get done at night and daytime for people to come in with suspected recurrent DVT and don't have it. And in many of those cases, it's a PTS flare-up. And remember that PTS is relevant to that person's life at that time. In other words, if you use Epic and identify some patient that had a DVT 7 years ago and you cold call them, I think it's worthwhile to do it, but having said that, the yield is very low because you don't really even know that PTS is an active issue in their life or not, right? Someone that comes into the ER, though, with a flare of leg symptoms, presumably it is at least a little bit relevant, right? And so that could provide an opportunity. I do think that another to-do item is to really re-engage the vascular ultrasound labs from the perspective of identifying chronic DVT patients. In a few sites, people are identifying acute DVTs and just following them for a few months. That's doable as well. That's how we enrolled the ATTRACT trial, actually. But one can do that as well, although the yield, of course, is challenging there. But certainly, identifying the chronic DVT patients from the ultrasound lab is something that is doable. So I think that partnership is definitely worth re-exploring. Because, you know, again, these are the patients, places where the patients are congregated, right? Yes, Stan.
It's just a question, we have recruited any patients yet, but in terms of looking through the ultrasounds, or in terms of trying to screen through ultrasounds that show chronic DVT, if you don't see common femoral vein DVT, have people found that there can still be iliac involvement, or do you like to see common femoral vein?
Only if there's continuous non-invasive form. I think there's more of an interest to take a look at what's going on.
Yeah, I think on a volume basis, and I'm sure that of the ones that have an open common femoral, I'm sure a minority have some abnormality up higher. But the yield, if you're doing it on a volume basis, the yield is going to be a little bit tough there. I mean, now you can do a secondary screen of the medical record and see what kinds of symptoms they have, right? If they have symptoms up in the thigh, or if the previous DVT was in the iliofemoral segment, then it may be a better proposition. But that does require a bit of effort. You know, it takes time, and it's not. And when it comes to looking for that kind of information, most effective if a physician does it, but then again, time-wise, that's a tough thing to pull off. It can be effective with the coordinator doing it, but then again, it's going to vary a lot among the experience level of the coordinator and things like that, right? I mean, it's not always easy to pull out of the record whether this really is what we're talking about or not, right? And PTS is not always a diagnosis that's made in a crisp and conclusive and easy to understand way, That's just the reality of it, But I do think that looking at that, and even if you say you're going to just look at the ones that have a common femoral abnormality or whatever, I think that's valuable. Because I think that, there aren't many places in the system where these people focus and congregate, And it's probably the one, that there in the hematology clinic, maybe the two places where you might get a significant number, I had another question for the group. What was my question? It was, Christy, you mentioned Epic tools, and what I'm wondering is, have you, from the time you started to implement these kinds of things to now, have you updated your query? Have you changed your search terms? How many patients do you get via the query, and how much work are you doing to review that?
Well, we just got permission to do this. It's taken us over a year. To be able to have access for recruitment.
Then that's because of local governance issues? Or because
Northwestern.
Because the IRB, it's approved by the IRB, central IRB, but the local EPIC governance institution is different, obviously.
Yes, but we'll be doing this next week.
Oh, okay.
So hopefully we can report on it.
Okay.
Are
other sites using EPIC actively, or other EHR systems actively?
I don't want to. I'm going to put her on the spot. Christine's here from Gunderson. You guys, I think, have really used EPIC to create some streamlined search reports. I don't know if you feel comfortable sharing a little bit.
Well, if I can tell a bad joke, I can talk about this. We use EPIC in a couple different ways. One is actually a workaround. It's not true EPIC. Our data writers wrote a report that pulled out all the ICD-10 codes that might apply to this, and it runs it weekly for all the patients that presented to our health system. We're integrated about 150-mile radius. So all the patients that even had anything with the ICD-10 code gets dropped to us, and then the coordinators will start filtering through that. And then we also get reports with all the scans that come through. So we'll, as we think patients are candidates, we go ahead and we filter up to our PI and our sub-I for review. And then what he also does is he sends a staff message to all those providers who have patients in the region who have these symptoms. So it's a personal one-to-one touch. Other things we do are trolling schedules for as they come in. We have a report that will pull all patients that have DVT so we can see the future patients coming and look at that. And like other people, I'm hoping to get our VPA to pop up in the next month or so.
Thank you. VPA is a best practice alert for those of you who may or may not use it. But EPIC has a way that you can basically flag patients that that are in the clinic in a sense, in a more real-time kind of sense, and notify other providers of patients that may qualify, basically. So there are different kinds of EPIC tools and reports you can run. It doesn't require you to take some time to engage with your team. We can help share our search terms and others' search terms through the network to make that an easier process for you, so that when you approach your Epic folks, you've got something to show them already. We'll try and share that again. But you know, this is something that I think when you do it, it does require rechecking, because the range of you know, information you can get, you might get very few patients with the queries that design, but you might get way too many to screen effectively as well, as we did early in our early first year. You know, so it does require relooking at it periodically. Other thoughts or questions? Enrollment barriers, calendars, study nuisances.
It's me.
Okay, so maybe we'll then probably break early for lunch. Angela, I was supposed to say something, right?
just Angela. I was just gonna remind folks that for the afternoon session, first of all, come back. They don't want to have to go to the beach and find you. So at 1 o'clock, we're gonna start again. But investigators will stay in here for the afternoon session from 1 to 3, and then the coordinators, we're gonna take a walk across the breezeway. We'll put some signs up for the Cumberland C room in the conference center. Like I said, we'll have some signs up. Lunch is gonna be out here in the foyer, and it's box lunch, so it's certainly mobile if you wanna take advantage of the sunshine. And then, like I said, we'll come back here actually after an afternoon break and wrap up. There are a couple individuals who have to catch some early flights, and so we'll make sure we connect with you again so that you're comfortable knowing where you're going to go and where the transportation services will pick you up. So.
Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy.
Is that just going to be in the hotel lobby here?
Pick up, yeah, and I was going to double check. I think you're on like maybe.